Welcome to the She Did It Her Way podcast, where it's all about making the ultimate leap from your 9 to 5 and building a business and life you love, all while doing it your way. I'm your host, Amanda Bolin. Let's get started. Today's podcast episode is brought to you by my free 5-day live course all about online business bootcamp for beginners, where you are going to learn how to build a profitable online business you love using the skill set that you already have. The course goes live starting Monday, October 28th. Be sure to enroll at shedidithewaypodcast.com/bootcamp. Again, it's 5 days. It's delivered to your email inbox, all about how to build an online business bootcamp for beginners. Head to shedidithewaypodcast.com/bootcamp. Hello, my fabulous She Did It Her Way listeners. Welcome back to another episode of the She Did It Her Way podcast. Today, you guys are in for a real treat. I have the lovely Miss Erin Lowry from Broke Millennial on the show. She's an author, she's an entrepreneur, a speaker, and I'm just super excited to have her on and talk to us about her journey on how she chose this non-traditional career path, which I know so many of you are inspired by just the journey emotionally and everything tactical and strategy-wise that our guests take. And so without further ado, Erin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, why don't you, in your own words, tell us what it is that you do, and then I always love to back up, right from the moment when it first started and kind of how you got to where you are today, and then we'll just dive in right from there.
Sure. And I feel like me, as with pretty much every other self-employed person, has no good way of explaining what they do. I'm still working on that cocktail party elevator pitch version of myself, which some friends of mine and I have actually joked about how we give answers based on how much further we want to take the conversation.
Yes. Because
if you say something just like, I'm a writer, people are usually like, okay, and just stop right there. Yeah. And don't ask any more questions. But I'll give you the skinny.
I love
Essentially, I do a lot of different jobs, but my main one and my big goal is to just educate people how to handle their money better. And a lot of that comes from actually more of how you have an emotional relationship with money, not just the nitty-gritty of here's how to handle money. Because let's be honest, as much as economists want to think that we are rational creatures, we are not. We are very emotional. Mm-hmm. And that pretty much impacts everything with our financial life. So I like to bring a lot of that in. I've written 2 books. I'm currently working on my third. The first one was Broke Millennial, Stop Scraping By and Get Your Financial Life Together, which is just kind of a general overview of everything you need to know to lay a strong foundation for your financial life. And then the second book that came out a couple months ago is Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, A Beginner's Guide to Leveling Up Your Money. And as the name implies, it's all about investing and learning how to invest. Because I'm going to be honest with you, you cannot effectively build wealth unless you are investing. And it's a critical thing that all of us need to learn how to do. And the third book that I'm working on right now is actually all about relationships and money and how to talk about money. Mm-hmm. Because it is so critical that we actually learn how to communicate about this in an effective, healthy way. Now, what do I do outside of that? Well, as you mentioned, I'm a speaker. So, for example, getting on a plane tomorrow and flying down to Alabama to give a talk. I speak all over the country as well as internationally about financial issues, kind of across the board about what I talk about, everything from how to get financially naked with your partner to how to get your financial life together in general to more of a fireside chat Q&A and sometimes more consulting type work. And I also write for major media outlets as well. And trying to think, anything else that I do? And well, I run the website, brokemillennial.com. I'm going to be honest. I long ago left behind the moniker of blogger, and I never was a good blogger to begin with. And we can get into that later. But that's really just more now of a standing website that talks about who I am, what I do, and has an archive of all the original work. And now I mostly focus on the books as well as writing in major media outlets.
Mm, yeah. And I definitely first of all, congratulations for writing a book. I feel like if anyone can, write one book, that is such, there's so much time, energy, emotion that goes into writing a book. And now you're on your third one, in which I do want to dive into some of those topics, because it's so important. And like majority of my listeners, like I shared with you before, are still in their corporate job. And there are some that have already taken their leap and they're out on their own. But that money in terms of budgeting, but also I know like when I left my corporate job, my question was, okay, well, how do I still get health insurance and how do I still get retirement? And then it's even still been a journey of like, when it comes to, okay, now here's my retirement options, but where do I invest my money that is actually, you know, going to be the most efficient and effective for what I want to do. So I'm excited to dive into that. Take us back. Like, so you, I mean, on your website too, you share this story about how you had Krispy Kreme donuts when you were younger and you made like $30, but then you had to pay out your dad for $5 of the like cost of goods. And then you had to pay your sister. So you had a profit of $20. And that was really your first experience into like money, and it's held with you all the way through college and after that. But like, talk to us about when you left college and your career path after that. And you know, you were living in New York with, I think you mentioned like it was like $20,000 or $30,000, and it was, the poverty line was almost like $19,000, but you were somehow like able to manage your way through, and just based on what you had learned through managing money, you were able to be smart about it. So I would love for you to pick up your journey at that point and then talk to us about like, how did you build your brand into where it is today? And kind of we'll take some detours throughout that journey and story.
Well, it was $23,000 approximately, and that was working three different jobs. So it was a tiring phase of life when I first moved to New York. But I moved here and my first job, which was my main gig, was working as a page for The Late Show with David Letterman. And that job had such odd hours and I didn't earn enough to pay my bills working that job. So I had to supplement with other things. So I would be a barista at a very well-known coffee chain in the morning. And then I would go from that job to the Letterman gig. And then from the Letterman gig to babysitting. And most days, I would say probably 4 days a week, I was waking up at about 4:30 to get to Starbucks when it opened to work the first shift. Then I would get cut at around 11 so I could make it over to Letterman. Depending on if it was a two-show taping day, I would get cut at around between 5 and 7, depending on the day, from Letterman. And then I would go babysit until around 11 o'clock. And rinse and repeat. Mm. It was rough. And I'm 30 now. I look back at 22-year-old me and just think, wow, the level of sleep deprivation that you could survive on was really impressive, because today me could not do that at all. And, you know, some days were, you know, maybe I didn't have babysitting or maybe I didn't have the morning shift at Starbucks, but I would say a lot of days were like that. And I still was not making very much money in putting in a lot of hours. But I loved it. It was just that early, you know, the romance of moving to New York and hustling. And, you know, I'm waxing poetic about it now. There are definitely times during it that I'm like, this is the worst. This sucks. But at the same time, I was living the dream that I had had from the time I was quite young. And that was to move to New York and to make it on my own. Now, I will say I had a huge thing going for me, and that was no student loans. And the reason I didn't have student loans is because when I was 18, my parents, it's a long story that's chronicled both in the book and on the blog, but basically my parents sat down with me and my dad slid two different bills across the table. And one was the school that I wanted to go to and how much it was going to cost me, because the deal in my house was you had to pay for 50% of your college education. And that's still me being fortunate that my parents could afford to cover, and willing to cover, I should say, the other 50%. And the other bill was for the school where I had academic scholarships, and that covered my half. And so I ended up picking the school that wasn't my dream school, but I knew I could come out debt-free. And the kitschy line I use about that is I gave up going to my dream school in order to live my dream life. Mm. Because the way that my parents talked to me about money from an early age set me up to, at 18, make that sort of rational decision. And I was able to long form think through, well, I want to study journalism and theater. And we all know that those are not very lucrative professions. And I need to therefore not have this huge burden of up to $80,000 of student loan debt if I went to this other school. Like, how would I possibly survive? I was going to have to go get just a regular job. I wasn't going to be able to pursue my dreams. So that was a sacrifice I made in the short term for a long-term gain. Mm-hmm. And that is a big part of how I was able to survive in New York on that little money. I mean, my rent was not cheap at the time. I mean, it's higher now, but at the time it was $950 for my half of the rent. And that was before utilities, before making any other payments. So it was very much making sure that money went to cover all my bills. And then I was getting very creative about how to sustain in other ways, mm-hmm. Including, you know, I was babysitting. So lots of dinners at work. I was working at Starbucks, and when things got expired, you got to take them home. So I'm surprised my heart didn't explode from all the sodium intake from panini boxes and bistro boxes and whatnot. And it was just that kind of trying to tough it out and grind situation. But I will say I capped out at about a year of feeling comfortable doing that, because you mentioned earlier the health insurance thing. And that was really important to me. I wanted to make sure I had health insurance. And again, very privileged and advantaged in the sense that I don't have chronic illness. There was nothing that was like, oh, if you don't have health insurance, you're going to be in a tight spot. I was very fortunate, but I also wanted a job that provided that. So actually the next job I got was a corporate job. Corporate's a weird term to use for it. I was working in a public relations agency, but it was a traditional 9-to-5 job, had a 401k, had benefits, had paid vacation, the whole gambit. And after my year working at Letterman, still staying in New York, switched over to PR for a little while. And it was at that job that I started Broke Millennial.
That, okay. So to unpack a little bit there too, I just want to say, like, that is amazing just to, like, such a, I think, is foresight the right word? Just even on your parents. And to hand you two different bills, because it makes it more real. And even like someone, you know, when I was taking out student loans to go to a public university in the state of Iowa, and it was still a decent amount, like it was just, it, you know, money today is credit card transaction. Like rarely do people, I mean, you know, hold actual cash or like weigh it to make it, make the experience more real. And for you to choose and say, you know what, it's, you know, it's just as real as it is on this paper today as it's going to be when I graduate. And so what decision can I make to set myself up for long-term success, especially financially and what that looks like. So that's huge. When you left the barista, Letterman and babysitting and going to PR and you started the blog, like was it just sort of this passion project, or did you have intention to make it an online business and to be able to build your brand name as you're doing it? Or talk to us about that sort of that experience when you started the blog.
It was never my intention to make any money off of it. And I never really made money off of the blog itself, which we can get into in a little bit. I made some, but not very much. The blog was just a for fun project. I was working in public relations. I actually was still babysitting. I still had a side hustle. I have never just worked one job is a big takeaway of this whole thing, to be honest. But I was, you know, working a 9-to-5 public relations. And frankly, I was kind of bored. It wasn't something that I personally found stimulating. That's not a shot at public relations. It was just the type of work I was doing. It wasn't very fulfilling for me. The type of clients we had weren't ones that particularly piqued my interest. And I wanted some sort of other outlet creatively. And I had started taking improv classes, so I was kind of scratching the theater itch. But I wanted to do something with writing. And it was a very serendipitous conversation that I had with a friend of mine that essentially it was, we had had many drinks and we were at a local cafe in our neighborhood, kind of sobering up. It was like 2:00 in the morning. And we're just talking about, you know, the state of our lives at the time. We had met working at Letterman. She wanted to be in entertainment in a different way than I did. And at the time, she was working for two executives at a huge media company and hated her job. And she was someone who had moved to New York wanting to be an actress. She wanted to go for it. And we, at the time of this conversation, were 23 years old. And I said to her, like, you know, I don't totally understand why you are at this executive job or this assistant job, rather, because 23, you don't have credit card debt, you don't have student loans, Your parents are in a situation where they can bail you out if worse comes to worse. So why don't you get kind of the nanny, the waitressing, the whatever job it is that affords you flexibility to go on auditions, but also pays your bills? And she looked at me and she goes, to be honest, I hate money. I don't pay any attention to it. And I just hope I have enough at the end of the month. And this was a light bulb moment for me. And I totally understand how naive that sounds. But the reason it was a light bulb moment is because we don't talk about money. And what you grow up around is normal. So I was under the delusion that most people had, had a basic understanding of how money works. They talked about it with their parents. It was a healthy conversation. Clearly, I was very, very wrong. And that conversation then led me to start asking other people in my life what their relationship was to money. And I pretty consistently just got shut down. And that's when I knew there's something here. This needs to get fixed. And my other point was, if I, a journalism and theater double major who really hated math growing up, can feel confident handling my money, I can make other people feel this way too. Because it has nothing to do with being good at math or having taken finance or majored in business. And it doesn't really have to do even with how much you make in order to feel in control. There are plenty of people who make a lot of money that are living paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of people who make a modest income who are your secret next door neighbor millionaires because they do a very good job of saving and investing. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I wanted to create a space where we could start having these conversations. And that's where BrokeMillennial.com was born. And it was, I originally started anonymous. It was me mostly just sharing stories from my childhood and kind of silly ways that my parents taught me about money. And I used to joke in the beginning that my strategy was, I'm going to walk you through this funny story. And at the end, boom, you know how to set up a 401k. So I was going to trick people into understanding how to handle personal finance and be very narrative about it.
Mm, I love it. It is like, that is such, it's such a, and well, let me back up. It's really like you were saying, it's a personal experience and different experience in every single household growing up. And then that can shape, and I've shared my money mindset blocks and my money stories on the podcast in previous episodes too, where like you hear sayings where money is the root of all evil or money doesn't grow on trees. And you start to believe the things that you're hurt, that you were told or that were said when you were younger. And then to talk about money is like this taboo thing. But I love how, you know, that was the focus of Broke Millennials. So as you started blogging, when did the transition point happen? So you're doing this while you're at your PR 9-to-5 job. And then at what point were you like, oh, wait a second, there's like an entire opportunity here for me to build my brand. And then after that, I want to dive into some of like the actual strategy and tactical tips, not only just like if you're tuning in and, you know, in the daily personal life, but also like, how do you prepare yourself financially to make your ultimate leap? And what are some things that you really need to consider when you are quitting your job?
Health insurance, but we'll come back to it. So yeah. I would say, because the retirement part, frankly, is easy, and we will come back to that. I worked in a traditional job for a fairly long time after I started the site. I started the site in January 2013. That whole year, I stayed in PR, and the blog was continuing to get attention, and then it started to get attention from the media. So I started doing interviews. I was kind of one of the go-to millennial talking heads about personal finance for millennials. And started getting featured all sorts of places. And I also started pitching myself to write in different outlets because I wanted to be a journalist. So anytime that a reporter or an editor complimented my writing, whether that was on Twitter or via email or what have you, I would counter and say, do you have any openings for freelance work? And that was just a slow way that I started to build a writing side hustle on the side of my full-time job. Mm. I never really focused at all on monetizing the blog itself. There were certain people who started around the same time who got into the affiliate link game and all of that, which was very lucrative if you got in early and you were consistent and you enjoyed that. I did not. I didn't want to deal with it. So that wasn't something I focused on. I occasionally would do a sponsored post that would pay a little bit of money, but again, I was being very picky about who I took, who I partnered with, especially with financial services. But very long story short, the blog started to almost serve as a writing portfolio to open up into other opportunities. And a couple of things came my way. The first one was a different PR agency approached me about interviewing for a job because one of their clients was one of the most well-known banks in our country. I'm not going to name them, but trust me, you know them. And so I went through this whole interview process with this other PR agency. And back in my mind the whole time, I'm kind of thinking, oh, I don't really want to stay in PR, but this will pay me more money. And, you know, at least it's kind of aligned with what I'm interested in with finances. So, you know, let's just see. I have such a vivid memory of getting the phone call that they were making me the job offer. I had gotten an email that said, can you get on the phone? Because it was during the workday. So I left my office to take a quote unquote break, called the person back and said, listen, we really want to bring you on. Here's salary, here's title. But because you will be working for a bank, you're going to have to close Broke Millennial.
Oh.
And I thought about it for a half a second. And I said, I appreciate the offer, but I'm going to have to decline. Because I very quickly did the math on the difference between my salary that I currently had and the raise that they were offering me and what I knew I could make up in freelance writing. And I knew I could make up the difference. Hmm. So to shutter it, I thought this could be, I think there's legs here. This could be a long-term thing. And I didn't know what that thing was, but I thought that this had legs. And I'm glad I did that because about, man, maybe just a few months later, I got approached by two men who were starting a company in New York City and asked me to come in and beta test it. And in the same time, were interested in having me write some articles for another website that they hosted. And I went in and I beta tested this website. And while checking it out, I noticed that they had a little section for blog. And I said, hey, I see that you have blog. I clicked on it. You don't have anything there. What's the plan? And they said, well, we're not really sure yet. Do you have any suggestions? And I said, yes, I think I could run this. And they said, all right, write us a job proposal. Let's have a conversation. Nice. So I wrote up a job proposal, ran it by my parents to get their opinion on everything, literally created a job out of nothing, to be honest, created a title and what I thought the responsibilities should be and the salary range, sent it to them. And 3 weeks later, I was working for a fintech startup. So that's how I got out of PR and into a different 9-to-5 job. So now I still have healthcare. They still offered retirement benefits at this new job. And I was now learning a lot about financial products, which was also helping me in everything related to Broke Millennial. So there was now synergy between my at-home job, which they knew about. It was all very above board. And this job that I was doing during the day. Mm-hmm. I will also say for anybody who has any sort of entity like this, any sort of business idea, if and when you switch jobs, make sure it's in your contract that you own your idea. That is one thing. Yeah, that's one thing I was very careful about. I said, Broke Millennial, all derivatives of it while I'm employed for you, everything else belongs to me. Because a lot of times you'll sign a contract and ideas that you created while you worked for that company are products of the company.
It's kind of like, you know, that's a really great point because I wouldn't have thought of that, but when you think about, inventors, when they work for a company, the company actually most of the time, I think owns their inventions or the patents that happen, but something like writing or you having your personal blog, but then also working under this other company, the fintech company at the same time, like that is so good to know about. The other thing that I was going to say too is, you know, even through your journey and your story, like it wasn't that, and this is more of a reminder, not only for myself, but like listeners tuning in, like don't get discouraged if what you want, or maybe you don't even know exactly what you want, but like if don't get discouraged if it doesn't happen overnight, because this is a great example and story of how you're making these tiny, like micro adjustments over time to get you to where you are today. And so there's all these things that even though, you know, you're not going to do like a full clean break from your corporate job right away, there's so many things that you can do to position yourself in a position and align yourself in a way that will eventually like feed in and the efforts that you're doing are not lost. They're just building and they're going into, they're like depositing into this like invisible bank, I guess you, if you can say it like that. So I just really appreciate your story.
It's a good way to say it. And I will also say to call back to something you brought up earlier about how I started to set myself up to make a break. It was because I was working a full-time job that really enabled me to branch out. And one thing I recommend to anybody who's interested in self-employment, entrepreneurship, what have you, test your project, test your idea while you are still employed.
Yes.
Make sure that it has legs. I'm sure this advice gets repeated and repeated, but it is so critical because what can happen is if it's already starting to bring in income, then when you switch over, you're not starting from scratch and trying to build and dumping in your savings. It's already a self-sustaining entity. You might have to scale back your lifestyle for a little bit, but at least you don't have to dig into all of your savings. The other thing that I did is I had, everybody's risk tolerance is different. I actually have a fairly low risk tolerance financially. I like to be very comfortable and have a lot of cash reserves as well as investments. And I had over a year's worth of money set aside, liquid, not invested, that if I quit my job and everything went sideways and I couldn't get any work, I would still be fine for a year. Mm. Now that was kind of bare bones living, but I still would have been fine for a year. And that was kind of the metric that I had set for myself. And when I was working at the fintech startup, I was very aggressively putting money into my 401k every dime that I made working my side hustle. So writing any sort of brand partnerships, anything like that, that all went into savings because I didn't need it to live off of. So that was also, you know, building the coffers, if you are filling the coffers, if you will, for when I wanted to quit. And I also didn't go into this fintech job thinking I'm going to quit and run my own business. I really liked that job. The reason I ended up pivoting is I did what everyone tells you not to do. And that was I got a book deal and I left my day job. I didn't do it right away. I still worked for quite a while after getting the book deal, but it was starting to become apparent that there was going to be opportunity for more speaking gigs, for more work, and that was going to require a lot of flexibility. And the way that I wanted to be able to market the book also meant I needed a lot of flexibility. So I thought, hey, at the time I would have been 27 years old and I wasn't married. I don't have kids. I didn't have debt. I was really in a prime situation. And to be honest, my biggest life regret even now is that when I graduated college, I never really gave acting a true shake. Mm-hmm. I got scared and I thought to myself, I'm not going to do this again. I have to at least give this a try. And if it fails, I can always go back to work. And at least I tried. And that was really the impetus for me to leave my job and strike out on my own.
Yeah. And I, going back just really quick, what you were saying about how when you validate your idea, when you have a full-time job, I mean, I like you just energetically as an individual, you're in such a better state of mind and it's so good. I think like having your full-time job and then having clients on the side, especially if it's like a service-based business or you're doing freelance writing and things like that causes, even if it's 5 hours a week, it really conditions you and trains you to be a time management ninja and to be really forthright with how you're spending your time so that when it does come to that point, if you do decide to go out fully on your own, you've already exercised what it's like and what it takes to be as productive and produce the work that you need to produce within the constraints that you have. I've seen people go out and quit their job and say like, I'm going to figure it out when I quit my job. But what happens is that you then split your energy in thinking of, oh my gosh, I'm blasting through my savings and I don't even know what I'm doing. And if something doesn't work out immediately, your brain's going to, you're in a vulnerable position where your brain's going to take over and like potentially put you in these self-sabotaging thoughts. So yes, I'm right there with you and saying like, whatever it is that you're doing, like validate and build revenue on the side and know your goals, your income goals, and like how much you want to have saved and what that looks like in order, like before just blindly leaping.
It's so true. And it's really important as well that you think through all of the practical things that are not sexy, like how am I going to have health insurance? How am I going to continue to invest for retirement? Who's going to handle every little part of my business now, because that's one thing that's a real bummer about being self-employed is you are HR and your payroll. And I would recommend hiring an accountant if we're being honest. They pay for themselves. But every little thing, you're probably going to need a lawyer at some point. You have to decide if you want an LLC or S-Corp or just be under your name. You have to figure out legal ramifications depending on the type of business you're running. There's just a lot to go through. Mm-hmm. And it's helpful to start laying some of that groundwork as well, again, while you're employed, mm-hmm. because these things cost a fair amount of money.
Yes.
So it's nice to have good income coming in. Now, also when it comes to healthcare, unfortunately, there's not an easy, affordable solution necessarily for everyone. I was in a very good situation where I live in New York. I had access to health insurance provider Oscar, which is not nationwide. And if you were under 30, which I was at the time, you could be on the catastrophic plan, which was, I think, $170 a month. Mm-hmm. So I got free annual, well, free, quote unquote, but I had annual physicals covered, and that's all I went for. And if something really bad happened, I had a backup. Mm-hmm. But, and then truthfully, I got married. And I joke, people ask me now, how do you have health insurance? And I said, I got married.
Oh yeah. No, because I had left my corporate job when I was 24, and at that time, and I don't know what it is now, but I think under, like if you're 27 and under, you could still be under your parents' insurance, I think it was. So I was fortunate to have that at the time. But then in the 3 years prior to my husband and I getting married, I was definitely on the exchange, I think that's what mm-hmm. it's called. Like the, yeah.
Yep.
Those are not super generous plans for what you're paying for. I think in the good thing to know is that there's definitely options out there. So going and making that transition from corporate to entrepreneurship and being self-employed is that there are certainly different options you can go out and seek. I think the other thing too that I struggled with was just even like a personal finance situation. So when I left corporate, I still had a significant amount of student loan debt that had interest rates from 7.8 to 8.1%. And I didn't know, like, I didn't come from a family that was super like well-educated in terms of like having a financial planner, like even understanding what all these numbers and metrics mean. So for me, it was understanding, okay, do I even get a retirement account at this? Like, it's not even about like, okay, now that I'm on my own, do I need a retirement account? It's like, okay, now I'm on my own, but like, I still need to look at my whole entire financial situation and to say that, okay, sure, I could be doing retirement and putting X amount away tax-free, but at the same time, could I be using that money to pay off student loan debt that has a higher interest rate, potentially more than what a return on my investment might be? So like all those questions that really should have been addressed probably even before quitting my job, I needed to go through. But like, what was your experience in terms of finding the right retirement option plan for you, given your legal entity? And how did you go about that? Because there are different ones based on if it's an LLC or an S-Corp, correct?
There are. And I'll come back to that in a second. I just want to give one other piece of advice. And that is, if you have started to test your business idea and you're earning income and you're still at your day job, something I highly recommend doing, and I did this for several months leading up to my departure, I took my business in or my regular paycheck and put it all into savings for about 4 months. And I tried living off of the variable business income that I was earning. And this was a way to simulate the experience of earning variable income before I actually had to do it. And it was a really good way to put a ton of money into savings at the same time. But you also need to have your checklist of, here are my absolutely every single month I'm going to have these expenses costs. And that is your health insurance, your student loan payment, perhaps your car note, your rent or your mortgage, your utilities, you know, gas in the car, metro card, whatever you need, transportation to get places. Although once you're self-employed, you might be able to scale that back depending on your job. Mm-hmm. All those different costs, see exactly how much you need for what I would say are the bare essentials, and then how much money you actually have to make to have that amount of money. Because remember, when you're self-employed, taxes are not coming out of your paycheck before it hits your account. So you have to set aside money for taxes. My rule of thumb, every single time I get paid, now bear with me with this number, every single time I get paid, 45% of my paycheck goes into a completely separate savings account. And I call that my Uncle Sam's money because it is money that's earmarked for taxes. Why 45%? Well, I live in New York City, so I pay city, state, and federal tax. It's very expensive to live here, for one. But for two, that is also money that I know I'll have some left over, and that's my automatic retirement savings. So I make sure that I'm always putting money aside for retirement. And then anytime I pay quarterly estimated taxes, the remainder gets dumped into my, to pull it back around to your question, SEP IRA. That's what I use personally. Traditional and Roth IRAs are great ways to start, especially if you are not sure how much you're going to be able to put away. You could open a Roth IRA depending on your income. Right now you can put up to, I believe, $6,500. I can double check that real quick. But a SEP IRA, you can put so much more money in there because you can put up to 25%. It's the lesser of 25% of your earnings, or up to, I want to say 52,000. It could be 53, but it's in the 50s.
Yeah.
So significantly more money, even more money than you can put away into a 401k, which this year is $19,000. So I went with the SEP because I was hoping, obviously, that my income would continue to scale up and that I was going to be able to keep putting more and more away. It also, there's a lot of other pros and cons to it. Now, if I ever hire full-time employees, I have to offer them that retirement package as well, which is something to consider. But at the time, it made the most sense for me.
Yeah. And that's, I have a SEP IRA as well too. When, like, walk us through, because that, if you were to break down the steps and someone, let's say they're at the place where, okay, they've decided LLC or S Corp, they've worked with the lawyer, they've incorporated, done their due diligence with the city, they have everything set up. Now they're like, okay, I got to select this, the retirement vehicle. Setting, like, let's say they do the SEP IRA. What was the next step that you took in terms of, because really it's the vehicle, but you get to decide what type, this goes into the investing portion. I would love for you to share like that process and how to make that decision.
Read my second book.
Girl, yes. We are linking to that so you guys can check that out.
All right. I actually am going to skirt this a little bit because dear listener, don't know you. I don't know your goals. I don't know your risk tolerance. I don't know anything about you. So for me to be up here,
yeah, it's amazing.
But I do have to say, and this is important to understand, because I know nothing about you, for me to give you prescriptive investing advice is dangerous.
Yes.
Because investing should be aligned with a lot of different factors that are tailored to you specifically. And that includes something called your time horizon, which is just a fancy way of saying, when do you need access to your money? So there's going to be a difference in how you invest if you're 25 and starting or 45 and starting. You have to consider, you know, how much risk you're willing to take on those investments. You have to decide what type of investments you're interested in doing, kind of where your ethics are when it comes to investing. And I'm saying all of this not to just get out of answering the question, because I will give an answer, but I just want to lay this groundwork to have you understand that if somebody on a blog or on a podcast or wherever is prescriptively telling you this is how you should invest, no, they don't know you. They don't know your goals. They don't know anything about you. So that's not necessarily the right advice. Now, the answer that I will give is, if you're just in that feeling of almost the choice, like the paradox of decision or paradox of choice, I'm totally butchering the name of this, where there's so many options, you don't even know what to pick.
Yeah.
Or there's so many options and you don't understand what any of them mean yet because you're just starting to learn about investing. There is an option. And that option is known as either a target date fund, a life cycle fund, or an all-in-one fund. These are all essentially the same thing. They just go by different names. So let's say, hypothetically, that you plan to retire at around that target age of like 65. And let's say that that's going to happen for you in 2055, using nice round numbers, because target date funds tend to be in increments of 5 years. So when you log into your investment options, you would search for Target Date Fund 2055. And what that's going to do is when you're younger, it's going to take more risk. It's going to invest you in a portfolio that's higher stocks to bonds. So you're, you know, more likely to earn a nice return. And then as you get, you know, in the middle of your investing journey, it's going to turn you into a more moderate portfolio. And then towards the end, when you're nearing retirement, it's going to get you more conservative. So it's going to take some of the risk off of your money. And this is something that's going to be happening automatically. You never have to touch it. It just automatically gets rebalanced for you. Sounds like a magical thing. It is not a silver bullet solution. The pros are, your money is actually invested. There are so many horror stories of people who put their money into, say, a 401k, an IRA, and never actually invest it. They're just putting it essentially into a money market account, not knowing that it's not invested. So it never actually grows and does what it needs to do in order to have enough for you in retirement. So this takes that pressure off. You make sure your money is actually invested. Now, the cons, though, are, one, it's a little bit more expensive because it's what we call actively managed. There's a human that's going in there and deciding the investments for you. So that costs a little bit more money. Every dollar you spend in fees is a dollar less that's growing and compounding for future you. So higher fees can cost you thousands to tens of thousands of dollars over the course of your life as an investor. So always good to pay attention to fees. So target date funds cost a little bit more. And the other thing is they are not tailored specifically to you. This is a one-size-fits-all solution to a population that's probably going to retire at around, let's say, 2055 in this example. So if you have a higher risk tolerance, well, maybe you would have kept a little bit more risk on there for a little bit longer and you would have made a little bit more return. Or maybe you're not actually planning to leave the workforce at age 65. So really, you should have modified it to be a little bit later, so risk was sitting on it for a little bit longer. There's a lot of different factors to consider. My point being, if you don't know what to choose at all and you just want to make sure your money is invested, a target date fund is a safe way to get started. But as you become more educated, more empowered, maybe you hire somebody to help you, you can then curate your investment portfolio in your 401k, your IRA, your SEP IRA, your solo 401k, whatever it is, to you specifically. If you put the money in a target date fund now, it is not locked up forever. You can always change it and build a portfolio that's customized to you in the future.
Do you have, well, and maybe you can't, because I've never actually, I think this is the first time that I've had someone that where we actually really dived into the investing. Are there certain platforms that you recommend? And I'm sure that they're in your book, and we'll link to your book as well so that listeners can get a hold of it and start to educate themselves on investing. But is there any that you've had really good experience with that you're like, check these out first? Or
I always have to be a little careful here as well so it doesn't come off like a brand endorsement. But I will say, the names that you're familiar with, like Vanguard, Fidelity, those are great options when you're getting started, especially in terms of fees. They've got really competitive fees. I know a lot of people ask about robo-advisors and the micro-investing apps. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to a robo-advisor, there certainly can be a lot of benefit of using one, but keep fees in mind. If you're someone who's going to be a really hands-on do-it-yourself investor, then you can actually do it yourself with a traditional brokerage like a Vanguard, like a Fidelity. But if you're somebody who wants a little bit more hand-holding, wants a little bit more help, you like the user experience of the robo-advisors, there's no issue with using them. And when I say robo-advisors, examples would be Betterment, Wealthsimple, Wealthfront, Elevest, all those guys. Mm-hmm. Totally can use them. They can be very, very helpful, but the fees are a little bit higher. And somebody I actually, from Betterment that I interviewed from the book, made the great point that he doesn't like the term robo-advisor. He feels like it's a bit of a misnomer because it makes it sound like just some algorithm is magically working in the background. You're like, that's not necessarily the case. He said online financial advisor is a better way to think about it because there is human elements. You could talk to a human if you want. Humans are helping build things out on the back end. So again, it depends on what level of, I'd say, service, hand-holding, what have you, that you want. And my last thing will be on the micro-investing apps. So this is your Acorns, your Stash, your Robinhood, those guys. Mm-hmm. No problem using them. I wouldn't be using them for retirement investing. I would go straight to the source on those. With micro-investing, what's kitschy is a bad word to use here, but I think what appeals to people is you can put a few dollars in and that feels very doable. And it's like, hey, I'm an investor. Now, here's the thing. Those guys charge, it depends on the app, but hypothetically, let's say you're in the bracket where you're getting charged a dollar a month. That sounds like nothing. I live in New York. I cannot do a load of laundry for a dollar. So I understand why a dollar to get into investing sounds like a great bargain. However, if you are only putting a couple of dollars a month into the funds, that dollar a month in fees is eating up all of your returns and then some. Mm-hmm. So the rule of thumb that I like to offer is if you're going to use a micro investing app, first of all, it should be in addition to something else. It shouldn't be your only means of investing. And maybe it's in addition to having a 401k within your employer plan or having an IRA set up because you're self-employed, whatever it is, in addition to. Make sure you're putting in at least $25, preferably $50 a month to make sure that you're really getting your money's worth with that fee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My husband loves the Stash and the Robinhood. I don't dabble too much in that. I'm more of a Vanguard index, set it, forget it, put the money in and just like let it mirror the market. But, I've experienced super high fees even in my retirement. And I like took finance classes in college and all of that. And they even talked about like, look for fees. And so I highly recommend, that just pay really, like, do what Aaron is saying and just pay really good attention that wherever you put it, just be really mindful of the fees because they could definitely eat into your return. And then that, like, if there's like a 5% front load fee, then you have to earn 5% and more just to break even based on the fee. So, again, this isn't a brand sponsored endorsement, but for me, that was one of the reasons why I switched to Vanguard because they do have lower fees, in that. So, this investing talk's getting me so excited.
And I will say too, that's a huge, I have a whole chapter in my book, Broke Millennial Takes on Investing, about fees and talking through, you know, you mentioned load fees, talking through what all of those mean, what that represents, why you need to pay attention. And I'm with you. I'm pretty just vanilla index fund investor. I'm not a big advocate for buying individual stocks. I went through the experience for writing the book. I was like, well, if I'm going to write about it, I should probably do it. So I did it just for the experience. I'm still holding the stock that I bought, so we'll see what happens to it. But it was very interesting because I never would have known even the language. I'm like, limit, stop limit. What are these terms? What am I being asked for with buying a stock? So it was a good learning experience.
I love it. Well, this has been absolutely amazing. And I kind of want to recap and close out a little bit just to highlight some of the things that we talked about. So one, I love the idea about how when you're first getting started to really encourage yourself to live off the income that you are making from your business to not only like simulate that experience, but then also get really clear and hold yourself accountable to understand, you know, how much do you need to live and in order to be able, and again, it's not like you're going to scale back your lifestyle for forever. It's just a transition, a time period. It might be a year, it might be 18 months, but scaling back and living in a more, like a minimalist way so that you can set yourself up for long-term is totally worth it. So I love that. Number two, definitely make sure you go check out Aaron's book on investing in terms of like what different options that you have when you become a solopreneur. And number three, which just slipped my mind and I can't remember it. I'm going to let you give us number three. So what is one thing that you have not shared on the podcast so far that you want to share?
Ooh.
Not to put you on the spot.
Wow. Yeah. Way to put me on the spot. Well, I'll say a couple of things. One, you can find my books at the library, and if they're not there, you can request them. So you don't have to pay for them.
Love it.
So be sure to always check out your library. And I will say too, I know I threw a lot of jargon in here and we had a lot. I went into the weeds at times, and I know that that can feel overwhelming. You may have pressed pause and come back to this later. Personal finance and finance in general can take a while to wrap your brain around. And it can also just be as simple as the way I'm explaining it might not be clicking with you, but the way someone else explains it will. So just keep seeking out different ways to learn about this stuff until you find that person or that podcast or that blog or that TV show or the book or the magazine or whatever that resonates with you, because it is out there.
So true. And especially with this topic, you're going to need probably more than once, twice, maybe three times, maybe four times to get, you know, to let it sink in, to really understand it. So I love it. Well, Erin, where can my listeners learn more about you? And then obviously we're going to go ahead and link to all this stuff that we talked about in our show notes. You guys can always visit that as well, but let us know where we can find you.
I'm very active on social media, so you can follow me on Twitter at Broke Millennial or on Instagram at Broke Millennial Blog. And I will also say, if you have questions, every Wednesday I do an Ask Me Anything in my Instagram stories. So come and ask me a question. And I also would say go to brokemillennial.com, the website. You can learn more about me. If you want to email me, you can do so from there as well.
Amazing. Well, Erin, thank you so much for coming on She Did It Her Way. It was a pleasure and a blast having you on today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a ton of fun.
If you enjoyed today's podcast episode, you can head on over to shedidithowaypodcast.com where you can access the entire vault of She Did It Her Way podcast episodes and more information all about how to make the ultimate leap from your 9 to 5. And if you enjoyed today's episode, I would be so grateful if you headed on over to iTunes and left a review letting me know what you love about the She Did It Her Way podcast. Until next time, keep doing it your way.